I'm Gabe Ortiz, afternoon host at WIPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make the live streams like this one more difficult to maintain. Stand up for public media and help fortify WIPR's future. Find out more and donate at WIPR.org. Thank you.
Welcome to Midday. I'm WIPR reporter Wamboi Kamau in the host seat for Tom Hall. There are more than 12,000 vacant properties in Baltimore. Even though that number is trending downward, it's still one too many. There are two ways out of this problem: demolition and rehab. And if we were to demolish ourselves out of this, it would cost at least $35,000 per house. That's according to a 2022 JHU 21st Century Initiatives study. Joining me in studio are two members of the Baltimore Vacants Reinvestment Council, or the BVRC, to help us walk through this multi-million dollar plan for the state and the city. State Senator Corey McCray represents Baltimore City's 45th District, and Reverend George Hopkins is the co-chair of Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, or BILD. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And both of them are originally from Baltimore. We've got Cherry Hill in the house.
Yes.
And as Senator McCray likes to say, the sun does what?
It always rises in East Baltimore.
So both of you have been on this council. It started last fall. I think the first meeting was in November. And in meeting, your goal is to decide how $50 million from the state will be spent to rehab at least 5,000 vacant properties within city limits. Tell us, give us an update of how it's been on the BVRC. What are your roles there? And what have you accomplished in your, 9 months of meeting?
One of the things, first, it's an honor to be able to serve and be able to get in the weeds, the granular level, and understanding what does vacancy look like within our city. But, like, my goals, and I don't want to speak for the entire council, but my goals is when we see that the reduction within the vacancies, we know that from a homeownership standpoint, that we're bringing a different level of economics. We're talking about generational wealth creation. We're also thinking about public safety, because that indirectly impacts when we decrease vacancies. We're also talking about education. So when we think about our schoolhouses, housing and vacancy is definitely indirectly impacted, because the more that we can reduce vacancies, the more students that we have in there. So collectively, we're starting to develop the framework to make sure that the systems, these systems in the city of Baltimore that have not always worked for decades, some of the challenges in the neighborhoods that you see for decades because the systems don't work, and being able to set that framework up and make sure that it doesn't just work for this year, doesn't just work for next year, but 20 years, 30 years, that we have that framework, we did the hard work so that the next generation can build off of our foundation.
I would just add that I'm not actually on the council. My colleague, Leslie McMillan, who's also a co-chair of BILD, is actually on the council. I've been present at all the meetings. For those who are listening, the meetings are public. I've been a part of many of the conversations. All I would add to what the senator has already said is that the important work of the council that is really critical is the implementation of the strategy for the next 15 years and making sure the intention and the values that have been stated are accomplished. And then the other component is the accountability of making sure what the goals that are set are actually done. Some of the progress made is there have been some work groups that have been created with those on the council and those who are outside of the council who have been a part of those work groups, making sure that things are being done between meetings. And the other is that next month of July, there will be an announcement for how the state money will be distributed throughout the city, which will be done a little bit faster this year than previous years.
Yeah, and that's something that I've heard Secretary Jake Day, who is the Secretary of the State for Housing, talk about. He really wants to make getting money into developers' hands easier. He wants to deploy it faster. Why is that important to get it out to people who can do the work quickly?
Yep. Just speaking to that piece of it, like, we have to have a sense of urgency. We have to be impatient about these opportunities that are in front of us. Why would something like that be important? Think about that homeowner that lives next to a vacant house that has a tree growing out of their roof. But more importantly, it's impacting the foundation and now impacting their basement from that standpoint. When we think about folks that live in concentrated areas of vacancy and, like, how many homeowners or how many folks are on that block, let's say there's a block that has 30 homes and only 10 of them are occupied. qualified at that time. That's problematic. But more importantly, Wamboy, when I think about the generational wealth in small neighborhoods like Johnson Square, Oliver, 4x4 that's being extracted, that's wrong on all levels. Sometimes I think that it's actually criminal when we aren't doing those things. And our responsibility as government is what I'm saying. So I just think we have to do better, but this council is a step in that right direction.
And on that note, $50 million from the state, that's taxpayer funded. But this is a bigger problem than $50 million. Through the work of Build, you've outlined that it would take at least $1.2 billion to fix this. What are some other funding sources? I mean, besides taxpayers like myself and our listeners, we can't have, as a pastor, you pass the plate around the church and people put money in there. Are there any people we can call in and say, hey, listen, we have this big problem and we'd like you to chip in and solve? What are other funding options that we have towards this?
So before I answer, this might be discouraging, but I'm going to make the numbers a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm. So the numbers are for the next 15 years. The plan is that it would take $3 billion of investment of public money. An additional that would leverage $4 billion of private money, private capital, to really solve this at scale. So one is over time of 15 years. The $1.2 billion is what has already been committed from the state and the city in the current plan. What I would say is what I am excited about is that you have state government, city government, who's ready to make that investment and commitment. You have banks who are ready to say, what is our part? Because we have been a part of the problem historically, and we want to be a part of the solution moving forward. And you have local foundations who are also saying, we want to be a part of this. And then on the ground, you have communities saying, what does it take for us to do? What can we contribute with our time and our money? And so my excitement for this current moment is that every sector of our current society in Baltimore City, everybody's on board of rebuilding our local communities. Mm.
My guests are Reverend George Hopkins from Build and State Senator Corey McCray. I'm Wamboi Kamau, your guest host for the hour, and we'll discuss more about revitalizing neighborhoods and rehabbing vacant properties after a quick break. This is Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm WIPR reporter Wamboi Kamau, filling in for Tom Hall. Coming up next Midday, Tom is back to discuss Turnaround Tuesday, an organization that offers leadership training, job preparation, and life skills to people looking for a new lease on life. Also, we hear from Olympian and activist John Carlos about his commitment to civil rights. Carlos is set to receive a Lifetime Visionary Award from the American Visionary Art Museum next week. If you're joining us, we're discussing the $50 million plan to revitalize and rehab 5,000 vacant homes in Baltimore in the next 5 years. Now we'll turn to challenges and potential roadblocks for this ambitious plan and a multitude of community partners that are critical to this development for the next 5 years. My guests today are Reverend George Hopkins, the co-chair of Build, and State Senator Corey McCray. So, challenges. I mean, this is monumental. We've just talked about funding. What about acquisitions?
I'll unpack that a little bit if you want me to. So, like, when I look at neighborhoods that's successful, I just want to lean in and lift up places like Johnson Square. Places that when you think about acquisitions, they're the ones that's putting the state partners, the city partners, the federal partners in one room to create a space where we have multi-housing that came to Green Mountain Chase. When you look at the teacher housing concept that's already come to fruition in the 400 block of Biddle Street, but more importantly, more housing and a library coming right there at Green Mountain and Biddle. So like when I think of BVRC, they're the blueprint, they're the model that we have to scale. That does not get done. And I'm glad to be sitting next to my brother, Reverend Hopkins, because organizations like Build. When you think about challenges, organizing from the ground, getting people to believe that hope is coming, that something tangible is coming to their neighborhoods. So when I look at the model for Build, it's a top-down, bottom-up approach. Organizing in the community, making sure that you're grabbing them with them, showing them how it's done, how do you do that? But then the top-down approach, organizing money. When you talked about state government, making sure that it's reflective, making sure that the banks, making sure that people are paying attention from that standpoint. When we think about, you talked about acquisitions and challenges. judges. So when I looked at the courts, so like I've been in the neighborhood 4x4 for about 5 years. And when I looked at some of the challenges, we couldn't even get access to the properties, even if we wanted to over a period of time. How does something like that happen? We didn't have enough people doing at the city level doing the title work. That now gets addressed. We didn't have enough folks on a court level. We've actually funded that in the state budget now that we know that that's happening. Sometimes mistakes would happen and making sure that the proper notification was going in a newspaper to that extent. And then the judge may say, hey, no, you got to start over because they are due their due process. When you get to micromanage at a granular level, you get to solve these systems and address these types of problems from that standpoint. But those were some of the early identifiers. And you have to make sure you got the right developers at the table. You just can't go and grab anybody from that standpoint, Wamboy. I'm going to stop right there because I see y'all shaking. I want to make sure my man, Bradman Hopkins, get in here.
But you said that all so well. And thank you for laying out how build works, right? From it's not just top down. It's also bottom up. I just was this morning was in a neighborhood, Franklin Square, where we were doing a cleanup with local leaders where they're organizing there. And you don't necessarily start with the $50 million plan in your neighborhood. You start with what's happening right outside my door. Who can I work with in my neighborhood to do that? And the more local wins is what we call it, the more local wins you have, the more power you have to determine the work you move forward. One of the key values of this work is that it be community-led development. That's going to be a crucial part. And I think the reality is this is such an important work. And we're saying we want to dismantle redlining, which started here in Baltimore, was perfected here in Baltimore. There is nothing that's going to be easy about it. And so when we see things like acquisition and other challenges that come up, what I'm grateful for is having leaders like Senator McRae to say, hey, how do we creatively and collectively address these obstacles? Because dismantling something like redlining is not an easy task, but is a deeply meaningful one.
Yeah. And on that note about building communities from, you called it a bottom-up approach, mm-hmm. making sure that people have the willpower to go after this and to take care of this, you know, as I cover this story, one thing I'm realizing is that there's a lot of people who are just tired. Because as you both pointed out, if a tree is growing through your roof, it didn't start yesterday, right? So we have a clip here that we're going to play. It's from Reverend Brent Brown, one of your colleagues, Reverend Hopkin, who is a pastor at Greater Mount Harvest in West Baltimore. And he speaks to that frustration, just the emotional challenges that people are facing before they even address this work.
I just got to be patient, let things play out the way they're supposed to play out. I know you want me to calm myself down and move on so we can get on out of here. But let me tell you, I've been patient long enough. The houses across the street from Greater Harvest have lied vacant for darn near 30 years. I've been patient. I ain't been patient by myself, but the reality is members of Greater Harvest have been patient. Patience feels like when the owner of 1620 West Saratoga Street sends back a message that I don't want to sell to no church because I want some real money. Trust me, I've been extremely patient.
Again, that was Reverend Brent Brown talking about the frustration of being patient to get this work done. So what about for those of us who live in neighborhoods that don't have strong leaders like they do in Johnston Square with Regina Hammond, or don't have a representation such as you that's going to go and find out why is there a backlog in the courts? Can I get the housing commissioner here to look at these properties? What can those of us who don't have those kind of resources do?
I would say two things to that. One is we just celebrated Juneteenth yesterday. And, you know, when I think of how people must have felt learning that they had been freed from enslavement, there was these challenges of, OK, I can now go and be, but do I have the right to vote? Am I a citizen, right? Which is where birthright citizenship came up. Where can I live? Where can I work? And that's where redlining came into place. It basically said, no, you can't live here. And so the endurance of patience has been not just in this generation, but it's been for generations. Preach. So for me, I feel it's where we are as leaders. Are we going to be leaders that finally say, not finally, but many before us, but say, let's continue this work and address it? But then the second part is, you know, you named a number of leaders that we know of, but none of us became who we are without being developed. If I could tell you, if we had time, I could tell you how nervous I was when I first got involved with Build and how Build trained me and moved me forward. And I am the leader I am today because people surrounded me and invested in me. And so there's, I believe wholeheartedly that there are dozens and dozens and hundreds of people who are ready to lead. And I agree that people are tired, but once we can find a way forward, then people say, hey, what's my part and how do I move forward? I'll just quote Ella Baker, who said, people don't need us to lead them. They just need the light to see their own leadership. Mm-hmm. And so my task, Bill's task, and many of us as leaders is, how do we just give a light of hope that something genuine and transformational was happening here, and that many people in our communities have a part, a significant part, in seeing that be done?
Well, boy, I just want to say the pastor that was on there that just gave the excerpt, that you just gave the excerpt, he's right. We should be impatient. There is a level and sense of urgency that's needed each and every day that we wake up. I'm glad to be sitting next to a son of Baltimore, as a son of Baltimore myself. Like, I see this community. I benefited from it. And my job is, while they're cultivating and building leaders, mine is to make sure that government work, make sure that it's not sitting on someone's desk, making sure that everybody in the game, in government perspective, is developed, is making sure that they're moving in a sense of urgency. I was apathetic about government. When I talk about, like, folks like, hey, did you ever think you've been saying no, because I didn't start voting until like my mid-20s. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to see the system work for a city that I love, but more importantly, a city that needs it.
And one question is coming in from Ellen in Baltimore City. She wants to know how the priorities will be set through the BVRC, of which properties are renovated and which families get to move in. Ellen, are you still with us?
I'm still there, and I wanted to thank Senator McCray for his wonderful work. I've been a Baltimore City resident for over 50 years, and I'm excited, but I'm also concerned, because when families move into these beautifully renovated properties, how will they get supported in terms of maintenance and, you know, all that's required to be part of a community? So thank you again for your work.
Thank you for calling us, Ellen.
And Ellen, thank you for the great question. I'm not answering for Senator McCray, but I would say a key part of the work is community-led development, which means our communities have to be developed as leaders and organized. When a community determines the development in their own community, they also have skin in the game to maintain and sustain that. Not just the housing development, but every component of how they're designing a community. As you mentioned earlier, Senator McCray, from the library and apartments happening in Johnson Square, those plans were made by the community, and those plans that people are now seeing are the work being driven by the community. So for us, it's really critical in this 15-year plan that it is locally driven by local communities, so that when people move in, they are part of a community that's also continuing to determine their own future.
Yeah. And I just want to thank Ellen. And it's a phenomenal question. And my job is to make sure that those folks that are historical legacy residents, making sure that they're actually taken care of. And as we cultivate who's going to move into the vacant properties from that standpoint, and be very thoughtful in reference to that framing. We also have programs like Bernie, the Baltimore Regional Neighborhood Initiative, when we're taking care of the legacy residents, as we're taking care of thinking about like the BVRC's work. You have programs like Community Legacy coming out of DHC. So there are a number of programs that also complement the work of the $50 million to make sure that we're protective and wrapping our arms around the folks that have historically been in our communities.
And I'll be remiss to not add that when this plan was initially announced with Build, Greater Baltimore Committee, and Mayor Scott, and now has continued to move forward, there were some key values that we all agreed to, not just the numbers, but the values of it being community-led development, it being no displacement, mm-hmm. and it being mixed income and affordable housing. Those will be values that you will see in every component of this work that are determining the works and how we move forward.
And everybody signed off.
Everybody has signed off on those values. The council yep. also revisited yep. them and signed off on those values too.
And while it is important that, you know, this is being community-led and from people from Baltimore, could that also be a blind spot where you are kind of one-dimensional in how you see development being done? For example, Senator McCray, you talked about redevelopment being done in the 4x4, mm-hmm. which is a neighborhood in East Baltimore that is very dense. Mm. So how do we factor in those kind of things what is the balance between, you know, rehabbing places because we need housing mm-hmm. or for historical or traditional purposes, when maybe they could be better used for green space or other uses that would still benefit communities?
I think that there's a great balance, and we I just had this hard conversation with my housing commissioner. I think that there's a great balance in reference to having the adequate amount of green space, because we know what the nature, we know what being outside, we know what looking at green opportunity does just from a mental standpoint. But at the end of the day, from a population that used to be a million, that's now close to 600,000, like, we got a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of opportunity in front of us is one of the things that I think about. So when I look at up north of Federal, so in Oliver, when you think about north of Federal, all that green space don't need to be on Bethel. All that green space don't need to be on Federal. We need to be making sure that we're thinking about what does housing development look like in an adequate proportional from a green space standpoint. But it's over green space because the housing is knocked down, but it ain't nothing there right now.
And all I would add to that is another key component. You know, I think people think about the money often, which is important. We need the money, right? The relationships. So the community having relationships with planners, the community having relationship with a developer that they trust, so that everybody's coming together. The community is living there saying, this is what we have seen. This is what we know. This is what we think we need. Developers saying, hey, this is what's possible. A planner having that same conversation. And we're seeing those relationships throughout the city in many different places. But those relationships of community, developer, local politicians, planning, people working together and saying, what do we want to create together, is I think which is the strength and the beauty of this work. And it will look different in every neighborhood, which is why we need leaders in their neighborhoods engaging in this work and in this process.
We have an email from Kyle. His question is asking if there's an effort made to use vacant demolition as an employment for people who live in some of these communities.
I think that there was some level in reference to, like, Humanum had a deconstruction program where they were thinking about what does deconstructing homes and things of that nature. I think that there's always some type of workforce and making sure that we're hiring folks within the trades and things of that nature from a Baltimore standpoint. But I think that Kyle, I appreciate Kyle because he's also creating a sense of accountability and making sure that he push this level of conversation that needs to develop and pop a little bit more up.
Yeah, I can possibly partly answer Kyle's question. I know for some of the nonprofits, like, for example, PHR, Park Heights Renaissance, or some of the other CDCs, the other community development corporations, they do work with other nonprofits like We Rise that that trains.
Shout out to Todd.
That trains people in skills like carpentry and plumbing and basically the building trades. So that's another way we can approach this conversation, or I can highlight in my reporting. So thank you for that, Kyle. And Stephen has a question about climate-friendly features. Mm. Is that anything that is being talked about by the BVRC? For example, having solar panels on roofs, EV charging stations, or really kind of building these homes for the 21st century?
I think that gets back to one of your previous questions of it, development looking different in every neighborhood. And again, with these community leaders working with planners and developers, coming together and saying, hey, what works best for where we are in our community, whether it's green space, whether it's being eco-friendly. You know, I think of the apartment building that has a library in Johnson Square. Like, that's not going to be needed in every neighborhood. And so we're not, from the BVRC Council, pushing down what development should look like in every neighborhood. We're pushing the values and the money, right, and the opportunity, and saying we need you on the ground to determine what's best for your local community.
And I know you mentioned earlier with the BVRC, there's different working groups. Is there a work, like, how do those working groups work? Is there one where just the philanthropists talk about money, or the developers talk about quality construction, or some of these features that the community wants to see?
So I sit on the one that deals with the systems in reference to just government. How does it flow out? Matt Gallagher is leading it. Faith, our city administrator, is also one. Faith Leach. I don't know why I was drawing a blank on the last name. But our city administrator, Madam Administrator Leach, is kind of leaning in, just making sure that systems work. So I sit in that work group. But there's about four or five of them that exist.
Yeah. And we should be able to name them, Senator. I know there's delivery chain, there's finance, there's data, and one more that is blanking. But again, most of these efforts are about implementation and accountability. They're not getting into telling neighborhoods how they must do the development, but making sure that what the state has committed to, the values and the money and the process, is being done. And then that work on the ground has to be determined by that local CDC and those local community leaders to determine what it looks like in their community.
And one boy, I sit on the delivery chain, so I just want to make sure the government working.
Yes, we need that government working. So, again, I just want to let our listeners know that you're welcome to call us. Our number here is 410-662-8780, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org. I am in studio joined by Senator Corey McCray, who represents the 45th District, and Reverend George Hopkins. And we're talking about vacant housing and this ambitious plan to solve the problem. One of the you mentioned banks as being one of the key partners in this work in terms of private financing. Earlier this month, PNC and Bank of America committed $100 million towards this effort. Have you heard of any other banks? Or you guys are from Baltimore. Can either of you call Carmelo Anthony or some of our other stars that have moved out and said, hey, we need X amount here, stat?
Yeah, I only want to clarify, because at the Build action that we had at the beginning of the month, Build mentioned that we need $100 million of private money. And we asked if the banks agreed with that and if they thought it was possible, and they all agreed. So PNC and Bank of America have agreed that $100 million is doable by the banks, and that they would also work with us, GBC and others, to raise that capital and bring other banks involved. I think we'll get there. I mean, every step along this way that we have gotten to, it has taken with people having a willingness to work together and then creating that access to capital. So I'm pretty confident that we will be able to make that happen, and that there'll be other banks who come on board, and that we'll have a structure in place for this to really work and benefit the local communities and the local CDCs who are doing the development work.
Yep. And I just want to say shout out to Harbor Bank, who's always stepped up within East Baltimore. They've done like this developer initiative where they've bought a block of houses right there in East Baltimore. They bought an anchor space right there in East Baltimore. And what they did was they spent their capital helping to develop these new developers that are trying to get in there. And that was pretty cool. So like the developers kind of pooled collectively their resources together. Harbor Bank helped facilitate, show them different paths. And then that creates and builds that foundation so that we got this next generation of folks. I also want to lean in and lift up the developers that we are able to work with right now. We just did ribbon cutting for Habitat for Humanity. With Mike Posco and them talking about 0% home ownership right there in Orchard Ridge, the old Freedom Way.
0% in terms of the interest rate.
In reference to the interest rate. That's important. So like when you think about 5, 6, 7%, like that's money that's created wealth within that family. When you think about St. Ambrose, who's always did about 20 or 30 homes right there in Northeast Baltimore and now stepping down to the 4x4, I salute them. Then I've just left Marcus Walker, who is doing a project on Ravenwood, burnt out house. One that developers normally would not take a second look at, stepping up and doing the hard work. Rebuild Metro. I would be remiss if I didn't say Rebuild Metro. That's facilitating, not just in Johnson Square, but they've done it in Greenmount West. They've done it in Oliver, and they're the blueprint helping to establish from that. I just want to lean in and lift up. Northeast Housing Initiative is another one. Like, I would be remiss if I didn't.
You're going to have to keep on going, Senator McCray.
So, I just want to say thank you for that opportunity to kind of talk about that work and some of the people that's doing that.
And I appreciate you saying that, because there's, you know, the excitement for this is there's so many people doing a lot of good work.
Mm-hmm.
And this, my excitement for what the state is doing, the city is doing, is coming alongside people who have already been doing work for a long time and investing in their ability to build capacity to really address the scale. So all those who have been doing good work for so long, acknowledging that, and hopefully this is a season where they're growing and able to lean in even more into the productivity.
And do it collectively. Yes. And do it under one umbrella instead of in the silos.
Yeah.
And speaking of leaning in, I also spoke with Mac McComas, who is a researcher who looks at this issue holistically. A couple of years ago in 2022, released a report through the 21st Century Homes Initiative talking about how much vacant housing is costing the city, not just financially in terms of the $200 million, but also psychologically, the effect that has on people when, you know, you're walking through neighborhoods. And this is what he said he's watching out for as this $50 million is soon to be dispersed.
Yeah, well, I think they've done a really good job in planning. You know, they're coming with a whole block approach, realizing that you can't address one single house, but you need to address everything that's going on in that block. They're doing a great job of working with small developers. So again, not just going with one large construction company, but making sure that there's spillover benefits to small developers, which create business opportunities. But one thing I think we need to keep in the back of our minds is that we are in quickly changing times. And so we might be in a very different housing market a year from now. So we need to pay attention to how neighborhoods are changing, what the job landscape looks like for people who might be moving into the city, and yeah, things like that.
That was Mac McComas, a researcher who looks at vacant housing, and he's also part of our WIPR board here. So the role of small developers, why is that important? And then I would like you guys also to respond to what he's saying about looking forward as the housing market changes.
Mm-hmm. Small developers are important. Again, you want to have development that doesn't displace people. Right, which has happened many times. It's kind of easier to do. It's quicker to do. But if you really connect with the neighbors and the leaders in the community, you mitigate displacement. So local developers often have good relationships with their community members. They can work with them and say, what do you want and how do we make that work together? And they're here. They care about the people of Baltimore. So not just building homes for the building home's sake, but building community, which is crucial. And I agree that things, we live in a world that's ever changing. I always say this, so we got to be mindful, like, we have the ability to create the city that we want to build. And so one, what is the city we want to build? And we are mindful that every home that we build is not sold. There's plenty of conversations that, again, I don't want to take up all the time here, of the absorption rate of how many homes do you build that can actually be bought, and how many homes are you building that will be rentals, and then, you know, some of those rentals will be sold 5 years from now. There's a number of methods and ways of how the work gets done. I just will continue to emphasize, we know what will happen if we don't act. And we are figuring out what will happen as we act, thinking about the potential obstacles and saying we are committed to solving those, but we will not stop rebuilding our communities.
So Mac did a phenomenal job of just laying out like why this is important and what keeps me up at night. That economy shifts. We saw it where interest rates were 4 or 5%. Now you'll see they're 7 or 8%. So like that's reality. And we have to take advantage of the moment where we have the right leaders. We have the right mayor. We have the right team. We have the right governor from that standpoint to collectively come together and says, what does the future of Maryland look like? And I don't think you get to say that without thinking about Baltimore City. And then when we think about like why is it important when you talked about developers. So you got folks that may do 20 houses or 60 houses a clip a year. But that small developer that's doing 5, 6 houses, like we have a responsibility to figure out what does that look like at scale. Because what happens is, I just told you I left Marcus Watt with a strong foundation, but he was immediately able to say to me, hey, Mr. Ricks, come on over here. Hey, Mr. Stanton, as he mm-hmm. talked about those relationships that are already respectfully there within the community. So like we have a dual responsibility, figure out who our historical partners are and work with them, but also thinking about what does that next generation of partners look like and build that. And one of the things with a strong foundation was they didn't have access. They didn't have exposure to like the elected official that helps them navigate these different waters. And that's especially important for us to do.
Yeah. And on that note of small developers, there's also a lot that I'm realizing, or maybe more than used to be, who are from Baltimore, right? Like you have Charm City Buyers and
Khalil,
and Mason Dixon.
Jason
Dixon.
No, you hit it. Mason Dixon, Jason Williams.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. And part of the, and with small developers, they're also facing challenges such as the permitting process. You know, what supports are there? I know you said you sit on the delivery chain committee or work group. So what are you guys trying to do proactively so that, you know, when people say, hey, yes, I want to go build up the city, they can streamline through it instead of giving up in the middle because it's just so frustrating.
So I just want to say what I wake up. So like mine's is just good customer service. And I don't care if you're a developer or if you're a homeowner or a renter in the 45th district, it's my job to give you presidential service. So my guy, Reverend Hopkins, knows I check my emails myself. I make sure that I'm getting an understanding of what's happening at a granular level. So Khalil, Kiara, they will already say, no, Corey, when we were having issues with DPW, I'll hold your hand and walk it over to that respective agency. Jason will say the same thing. Philip Stokes will say the same thing. Marcus Walker will say the same thing. Sean Klosky will say the same thing. So if you're big or small, my job is to make sure that government work. And that's specifically in East and Northeast Baltimore. Like if you talk to anyone that's working in that space, Warm Boy, I'm telling you, like we as elected officials have to raise the bar. And I don't challenge my other ones, but what I do is I try to lead by example so that they have an example to be able to say, okay, that's what I should be doing or that's what I should be mimicking.
That's well said. All I would add to that is, you know, part of the work and the relationship and the great moment we're in is also listening. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's a lot that we know that we're doing right now, but there's a lot that we don't know, a lot that we will learn in the process. So it's listening to those local developers saying, hey, I didn't see this issue. Now it's here. Now how do we problem solve it? And so it's just actively listening, which we've done a lot of listening with CDCs over the last year and a half. And we will continue to do that. And we do a lot of listening in the communities. We'll continue to do that. And when we acknowledge and find issues and problems, then we got to work together, which listening helps work together. When you say, I've been heard, now we say, how do we do this together? So on our end, it's a lot of listening and a lot of learning and then acting and what we've learned and then continue to listen again.
And you're listening to Midday. I'm WIPR reporter Wamboy Kamau filling in for Tom Hall. We'll talk more about vacant housing in Baltimore. After a quick break, my guests are State Senator Corey McCray and Reverend George Hopkins from BUILD. More from Midday in a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Wamboy Kamau in the host seat for Tom Hall. We're continuing our discussion on the state and city's initiative to address Baltimore's vacant housing in the next 5 years. Now let's take a look at where development needs to happen in the city and what we will see after July 1st or the next year after the initial tranche of funds are dispersed. My guests are co-chair of BUILD, Reverend George Hopkins, and State Senator Corey McCray. If you have a question or comment, please join the chat. Send a comment to midday@wipr.org or give us a call at 410-662-8780. Now, before we went on the break, Senator, you were saying that people can reach out to you, mm-hmm. but not everybody, you know, people shouldn't have to reach out to you mm-hmm. to do what needs to be done. So are you guys looking at that systematically that people, you know, if someone puts in a 311, it should be addressed. If someone puts in a permit, it should be, you know, filled out at the time that it's supposed to be filled out.
So I let folks know that while I am a state senator, I don't care if it's a local, state, or federal issue. Folks just want good government. And most of the time, they don't know the difference if you really want to get, like, at that level of that layer. And mine's is, like, no, it shouldn't work like that. But these systems didn't just break up or become broken over the last month, over the last several years. This is decades on top of decades of just an antiquated system that they need help navigating. I think that the agency is going to respond different when they see someone that may be in control of their budget or things like that. They hear it in a different type of tone. And what happens is I don't just send them that initial email. I'll follow up 7 days. I'll follow up 10 days and stay on it because at the end of the day, folks deserve presidential service. I don't care if you're the constituent or the developer, like, we have a job. They pay taxes to be able to respond. So, no, the system should not work like that way. You have to reach out to that elected official. But I do want every constituent to feel confident that when they do reach out to the elected official that they are looking into the respective issue.
So I'll get into some of the BUILD's training and why we do what we do, which we talk about the world as it is and the world as it should be and how to get the world closer to as it should be is mm-hmm. you really have to work on empowering people to know their own power and act in it. We talk about three sectors, the public sector, which is the politicians, the private sector, which is businesses, and the civic sector, which is the community. And community voice is mostly heard in our relational strength and power when it's not just one person. When it's a multitude of people, which is why we do work on the ground in the communities. And typically when we have to push for something, if it is with something not being done in a timely manner, it's hard to do it on your own. So if anybody's listening to this, the way we do this well as a civic sector, as community leaders, is to do it together. And when you go together, when you show up with five, when you show up with 500, people listen a lot more when you just do it by yourself. And so I would just encourage community leaders to continue to look at their neighbors and say, what are the issues we have? And how do we collectively have our collective power to step into this and make things change closer towards the world as it should be?
On that note of collective power, you know, a lot of these neighborhoods want a bunch of houses done at once because that's what keeps the neighborhood strong. Are there any measures that you guys are looking at in terms of controlling that so that they're done at quality?
Mm. I mean, again, I'm gonna keep leaning on this because it's so crucial. The community voice is crucial. If a community has power and strength together, they can hold their local CDC ideally together. Ideally, when this work is happening, there's a CDC that they're working with, and they are working at all this together. And if there's something they don't like, that community can go to that local CDC and have that conversation. If there's something that's not happening politically, that CDC and the community can go to their local politician together and say, this is something that we want. I just can't emphasize enough. We need homes rebuilt, but we need communities rebuilt also. And communities being able to lead and drive this, it is not only important, it is doable. And I think a lot of these issues that we're talking about can be solved when we work together and work towards accomplishing those goals together.
I just want to lean in and say, like, the permit, the inspectors, some level of quality control is done through government. Like, that's the role in local government. But also just being intentional about the partners that you're working with, looking at what that portfolio look like. What does that bandwidth from and of the city? When you think about all the people that you named, when we think about Rebuild Metro, you shout out Charm City Buyers, you did Mason-Dixon. Like, there's a certain level of brand. There's a certain level of quality that we know that we're getting when we invest in those types of partners.
We have a caller now on the line, Dr. Cynthia, and she has something to say about bringing communities together to help the process.
Hi, this is Cynthia Pace, and I was listening to your show, and I am heartened by the fact that we are in the process of solving a major issue in the city of Baltimore. This is not an upsell. I'm a certified professional facilitator. I facilitate meetings, groups, and conferences all around the world. And what I'm suggesting is that we access those professional services, which is a pretty narrow market niche, and call in people that have that skill set so that you can advance your outcome and get a great return on investment. And what I'm suggesting is that that could be something, if you have not done so and you've done it, but actually use professionals that do that kind of work.
Okay, thank you so much, Cynthia. That's a great suggestion. There's also, like you said, Bill, that trains people on how to have those kind of mediation type of skills. Is that correct?
Yes, and you know what I think the caller also helped us, what I love about organizing and knocking on doors and getting to know your neighbors is there's so much talent in our communities that we don't get to know until we relate to one another. And so I'm pretty sure, like the caller mentioned, there's many people with skill sets, and there's many people with skill sets in our community who might not even know this work is happening until we reach out, we connect, we realize that, hey, we have a lot of talent in many different ways that can contribute to this work.
And not to be a negative Nelly here, but sometimes you do knock on your neighbor's doors and you get to know them and you say, oh, wow, how am I going to deal with that person? You know,
that's hard, too. But, you know, this is what I always think of is who I am today, and not everybody saw who I am today 20 years ago. Right. And I'm a pastor. So I always see the good, what I call the divine dignity in every person I encounter. And I believe everybody has a part to it. Even the people who complain, the people who complain, I know if I have a meeting, we have an idea, I can expect that one or two people to make sure the idea is sound. They're going to question it. They're going to test it. And if it's sound, they should be able to test it and it should still stand. So it's not, again, none of this is easy, right?
It's meant to be.
Meant to be easy, right? But I think, you know, being able to realize that even the people who we might not get along with right now have something to contribute. And you never know where you are. I don't think the question so much is who we are today, but who we're becoming. And so, man, some people don't have a lot of hope. But if we can do something together, maybe we'll both have hope more together if we're willing to see the best in each other and to work towards accomplishing shared goals.
Juan Boy, just to kind of lean in on Reverend Hopkins' point, like I serve in a body of 188, so I got 187 other personalities. But what happens is I think that it's a better product. When you have gender diversity, when you have ethnic diversity, when you have age diversity, I think that the policies that come out in 2025 look a lot better than when it was 1930, 1950, 1960. And I think that that voice that you speak to, while they may challenge you, they're going to push you, they're going to help you find your best. Is what's going to be in that conversation.
I love the optimism here. A couple other things I'd like us to touch on is when this money is released, it's not all going to be released at once, right? Like that's one of the stopgap measures is to make sure that the work that people are saying they're going to do will be done. So if you're a developer and you ask for $200,000, you get it in stages or phases.
There's a structure and trigger. So you have, while DHCD is the agency that kind of it flows through, there's DGS that's involved. There's the Board of Public Works. So there are different triggers to make sure that we're protecting government money from that standpoint. Some will work through like a reimbursement process. Some may flow out with the cash. But at the end of the day, like the triggers are there to make sure that we're safe in protecting government dollars.
And then there's also something that was identified by the BVRC called the Baltimore City Vacancy Reduction Priority Area. Can any of you talk about that? What are the priorities to reduce vacancy throughout the city?
So when I think about priority areas, and I had this conversation with the housing commissioner, I think about South Clifton Park. Let's talk about places that I've done strong and places where I'm falling short at, if that's okay. When I think about my Harford Road corridor, I feel good about it. When I think about Johnson Square, I feel good about it. Oliver, I feel good about it. When I think about the 4x4, I know that we have a plan. But let's talk about some places where I fall short that I think is a priority to me. South Clifton Park, Dolly Park, Fort Worthington, Chum, like these are neighborhoods that I have to do better. I have to get more intentional. I have to stretch my muscles and figure out how to better resource those neighborhoods because they all pay taxes too. And that's when we think about the priority areas. I can clip them off in East Baltimore, but at the end of the day, we got them in South Baltimore, we got them in West Baltimore, and that's what I hope that we're intentional about thinking about in a thoughtful way.
Yeah, and Reverend Hopkins, I've seen you tarmacking as you go to organize more people, for example, areas like Westport. So are there any areas you want to highlight where there's strengths and room for improvement?
Yeah, I mean, great work's happening in Westport, Franklin Square, Coppin Heights, Druid Heights, Northeast Baltimore. There's good work in organizing that's happening all throughout the city. And there's places where we have conflict and we got to figure out how to work together. So I would just say this, you know, I am the optimist, but I think without vision and without hope, there is nothing to be done. We'll just stay stuck and stagnant where we are. I have seen more and more people say, is this possible? And what is my part? And I think that grows. The more you have success in these areas and more people say, oh, this is real. This is happening. I want this for me. I think it will continue to grow and spread and people will get more and more involved and have visions and plans for their communities.
Well, I thank you both so much for joining me for this conversation. My guests are Senator Corey McCray and Reverend George Hopkins from BUILD. That's it for today. Coming up Monday, Tom is back and he'll speak with Melvin Wilson from Turnaround Tuesdays and Olympic athlete and activist John Carlos. Fresh Air is up next and they'll remember Edmund White, one of the pioneering writers of gay literature. Thanks for joining us. I'm One Boy Come Out. Have a blessed day.
One Boy, shout out to you too.
Thank you.